Namaste. Happy Darshan Day. Let's begin by reading the message for the 24th of April. 2022, a passage taken from Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother. Harmony and beauty of the mind and soul. Harmony and beauty of the thoughts and feelings. Harmony and beauty in every outward act and movement. Harmony and beauty of the life and surroundings. This is the demand of Mahalakshmi. In a bit, we'll touch upon the significance and the nature of the 24th. But we continue now in our reading and essays on the Gita. We're in the chapter, The Creed of the Aryan Fighter. You'll remember this was in print and read first on the 15th of February in 1917. We got roughly halfway through the chapter. Sri Aurobindo recounts how Krishna, faced with Arjuna's recoil from the battle, challenges him from two perspectives. One, remember your culture, Arjuna. Remember who you are and what you represent. But more, remember what you are essentially. Who are you really? And both of these are amplified in the course of the 18 chapters, start from here in the second, all the way through the rest of the book. Krishna comes back again and again to enjoin upon Arjuna enlightened action. And we'll see what it means. But first, there is this question. Apparently, we die. Apparently, there is destruction. Great evil befalls the world. What are we to make of it? So, reading that last sentence where we put down the book last time, Sri Aurobindo writes, he looks beyond the apparent facts of the life of the body and senses to the real fact of his being and rises beyond the emotional and physical desires of the ignorant nature to the true and only aim of the human existence. What is that real fact, that highest aim? This, that human life and death, repeated through the eons and the great cycles of the world, are only a long progress by which the human being prepares and makes himself fit for immortality. Amritatvaya, chapter 2, the 15th shloka. He is asked there to make himself balanced and steadfast. And how shall he prepare himself? Who is the man that is fit? The man who rises above the conception of himself as a life and a body, who does not accept the material and sensational touches of the world at their own value or at the value which the physical man attaches to them, who knows himself and all as souls, learns himself to live in his soul and not in his body, and deals with others too as souls and not as mere physical beings. For by immortality is meant not the survival of death that is already given to every creature born with a mind, but the transcendence of life and death. It means that ascension by which man ceases to live as a mind-informed body and lives at last as a spirit and in the spirit. Whoever is subject to grief and sorrow, a slave to the sensations and emotions, occupied by the touches of things transient, cannot become fit for immortality. These things must be borne until they are conquered, till they can give no pain to the liberated man, till he is able to receive all the material happenings of the world, whether joyful or sorrowful, with a wise and calm equality, even as the tranquil eternal spirit secret within us receives them. That Purusha inside is unstained, unmuddied, untouched, unmoved by what occurs in the superficies of the natural being. This would be the teaching of the Sankhya. There is a deeper teaching, which the Gita makes plain later, which unifies all, and there is no absolute disjunction between Purusha and Prakriti, but it is useful to begin with that. By the way, we've reached, with this sentence, the second book, and this is the 15th shloka, the tranquil eternal spirit's secret within us. To be disturbed by sorrow and horror, as Arjuna has been disturbed, to be deflected by them from the path that has to be traveled, to be overcome by self-pity and intolerance of sorrow and recoil from the unavoidable and trivial circumstance of the death of the body, this is un-Aryan ignorance. It is not the way of the Aryan climbing in calm strength towards the immortal life. So Sri Aurobindo again takes us back to the root meaning of what is Arya. Arya is the noble, is the strong of wing, who soars in flight. So for us to be bound by the mundane circumstances of a transient physical existence means that we have identified with the wrong person. This is the natural person. This is not the spiritual person. And the spiritual person can also be the heroic person, can be and should be the kshatriya. There is no such thing as death, for it is the body that dies, and the body is not the man. That which really is cannot go out of existence, though it may change the forms through which it appears, just as that which is non-existent cannot come into being. And so we begin here, second book, 16th shloka, and we're going to run through the 25th, so 16 through 25. This is going to be a rough translation that Sri Aurobindo renders here into English. So, sat and asat, that old argument from the earliest Upanishads, shows up here again in Vedanta, right here at the cusp of the battle. The soul is and cannot cease to be. This opposition of is and is not, this balance of being and becoming, which is the mind's view of existence, finds its end in the realization of the soul as the one imperishable self by whom all this universe has been extended. Finite bodies have an end, but that which possesses and uses the body is infinite, illimitable, eternal, indestructible. It casts away old and takes up new bodies as a man changes worn-out raiment for new. And what is there in this to grieve at and recoil and shrink? This is not born, nor does it die, nor is it a thing that comes into being once and passing away will never come into being again. It is unborn, ajaha, ancient, purana, sempiternal, nitya. It is not slain with the slaying of the body. Who can slay the immortal spirit? Weapons cannot cleave it, nor the fire burn, nor do the waters drench it, nor the wind dry. Eternally stable, immobile, all-pervading, it is forever and forever. Not manifested like the body, but greater than all manifestation. Not to be analyzed by the thought, but greater than all mind. Not capable of change and modification like the life and its organs and their objects, but beyond the changes of mind and life and body. It is yet the reality which all these strive to figure. And now, verses 26 through 29. Even if the truth of our being were a thing less sublime, vast, intangible by death and life, if the self were constantly subject to birth and death, still the death of beings ought not to be a cause of sorrow, for that is an inevitable circumstance of the soul's self-manifestation. Its birth is an appearing out of some state in which it is not non-existent, but unmanifest, avyakta, to our mortal senses. Its death is a return to that unmanifest world or condition, and out of it, it will again appear in the physical manifestation. We never tire of saying, do we, that to manifest is to make plain, to make clear, to bring to the front. Always this exists in potential. The manifestation takes the infinite and fashions it into a form, makes it clear to the view. And every form is a symbol of that which it figures. So everything is pregnant with deep spiritual significance, no doubt. But no form can capture the all. It suggests. It connotes. So that which manifests is not intended to be permanent. It's a conveyance of a reality, and it's an empowerment. It's a capturing, a vesseling of the power into a form. Why would you want to be prisoner to one mood of manifestation when you are essentially infinite and capable of infinite things? The to-do made by the physical mind and senses about death and the horror of death, whether on the sickbed or the battlefield, is the most ignorant of nervous clamors. Our sorrow for the death of men is an ignorant grieving for those for whom there is no cause to grieve, since they have neither gone out of existence nor suffered any painful or terrible change of condition, but are beyond death no less in being and no more unhappy in circumstance than in life. And this is plain, this is vouchsafed to anyone who realizes what they really are. When you realize Atman, when you realize Brahman, you know that the conditions of life and death are merely transient presentations, waves of becoming, rolling out from this immortal, infinite being. But in reality, the higher truth is the real truth. All are that self, that one, that divine whom we look on and speak and hear of as the wonderful Adbhuta, beyond our comprehension. And after all our seeking and declaring of knowledge and learning from those who have knowledge, no human mind has ever known this absolute, because it cannot be an object. It is beyond being subject and object. It is, or it exceeds the description of what is, and therefore is not. Sri Aurobindo loves to play with this in the Life Divine. It is this, enam, this, chapter 2, verse 29, undescribed. It's not a name, it's not an it. This, it is this which is here veiled by the world, the master of the body. All life is only its shadow. The coming of the soul into physical manifestation and our passing out of it by death is only one of its minor movements. All of this occurs at the physical level. Remember, this is the physical plane, the plane of anam. And then prana, and then manas, and then vijnana, and then ananda, and then chit, and then sat. And we lament the passing of this vague, temporary circumstance of our, quote, being. When we have known ourselves as this, then to speak of ourselves as slayer or slain is an absurdity. One thing only is the truth in which we have to live, the eternal manifesting itself as the soul of man in the great cycle of its pilgrimage, with birth and death for milestones, with worlds beyond as resting places, with all the circumstances of life, happy or unhappy, as the means of our progress and battle and victory, and with immortality as the home to which the soul travels. And the beginning of that sentence was chapter 2, shloka 19. Now he backs up here, and we start with shloka 18. Therefore, says the teacher, put away this vain sorrow and shrinking. Fight, Yudhyasva, O son of Bharata. 2:18. But wherefore such a conclusion? This high and great knowledge, this strenuous self-discipline of the mind and soul, by which it is to rise beyond the clamor of the emotions and the cheat of the senses to true self-knowledge, may well free us from grief and delusion. It may well cure us of the fear of death and the sorrow for the dead. It may well show us that those whom we speak of as dead are not dead at all, nor to be sorrowed for, since they have only gone beyond. It may well teach us to look undisturbed upon the most terrible assaults of life and upon the death of the body as a trifle. It may exalt us to the conception of all life circumstances as a manifestation of the One and as a means for our souls to raise themselves above appearances by an upward evolution until we know ourselves as the immortal spirit. But how does it justify the action demanded of Arjuna and the slaughter of Kurukshetra? The answer is that this is the action required of Arjuna in the path he has to travel. It has come inevitably in the performance of the function demanded of him by his Swadharma, his social duty, the law of his life and the law of his being. This is 2:31 through 32. Now, the deeper law of being and the deeper significance of Swadharma too comes later when we connect Swadharma, the law of one's nature, with Swabhava, the law of one's being. See how one rolls out of the other. But here, this is the external side of what is Swadharma. He operates within a dharma, but he has a personal commitment to it as well, to fulfill the mission that has been imparted to him, which his soul accepted in its manifestation. Remember, we are not accidentally here. We are missioned forth. Sparks from a great fire. This world, this manifestation of the self in the material universe is not only a cycle of inner development, but a field in which the external circumstances of life have to be accepted as an environment and an occasion for that development. It's the 24th of April. It is a world of mutual help and struggle, not as serene and peaceful gliding through easy joys is the progress it allows us, but every step has to be gained by heroic effort and through a clash of opposing forces. Those who take up the inner and the outer struggle, even to the most physical clash of all, that of war, are the Kshatriyas, the mighty men. War, force, nobility, courage are their nature. Protection of the right and an unflinching acceptance of the gauge of battle is their virtue and their duty. For there is continually a struggle between right and wrong, justice and injustice, the force that protects and the force that violates and oppresses. And when this has once been brought to the issue of physical strife, the champion and standard bearer of the right must not shake and tremble at the violent and terrible nature of the work he has to do. He must not abandon his followers or fellow fighters, betray his cause, and leave the standard of right and justice to trail in the dust and be trampled into mire by the blood-stained feet of the oppressor because of a weak pity for the violent and cruel and a physical horror of the vastness of the destruction decreed. His virtue and his duty lie in battle and not in abstention from battle. It is not slaughter, but non-slaying, which would here be the sin. This has cosmic significance. You remember the cosmology of India stretching back to the Veda. Opens with this manifestation, this pouring out from the infinite mother, from Aditi, powers and forces released into the world, but losing sight of each other, losing sight of her, they oppose and repel each other and create darkness. So she has, in a sense, to rescue the universe, which too is her child, and she sends forth the shining ones, the bright ones, the devas, the gods, to do battle with these elder gods, the asuras. And so from the very beginning, there is in the very threads of the universe a tautness, a tension between these two poles. And we are trying to work out through the forces of these antinomies an eventual harmony, to discover the secret unity that allows us to pacify and greaten what seems to be dark, and to work in harmony all together. But until we get there, there are occasions where we have not to argue intellectually and not to oppose emotionally, but actually to stand and face the flood, to face the darkness, and send them to the end of the line if we must. Start over, my friend. You erred, and I have to put an end to your error. We oppose not from hatred. We are victorious because we must be. And just as Durga, when she slays Mahishasura, draws her bow, and the Asura begins to see what inevitably is coming, she looks not at the Asura. Her eyes are above, on the eternal, on the divine, knowing that what she does through her manifestation is the execution of her will as seen above, in time beyond time, in truth beyond circumstantial battle. And so, one can learn through karma yoga and through the execution of one's duty how to live in communion with that greater power and act when one must, sometimes to place a rose in a vase, and sometimes to lift the bright sword if necessary. But always to act divinely. The teacher then turns aside for a moment to give another answer to the cry of Arjuna over the sorrow of the death of kindred, which will empty his life of the causes and objects of living. What is the true object of the Kshatriya's life and his true happiness? Not self-pleasing and domestic happiness and a life of comfort and peaceful joy with friends and relatives, but to battle for the right is his true object of life, and to find a cause for which he can lay down his life, or by victory win the crown and glory of the hero's existence, is his greatest happiness. Quote, "There is no greater good for the Kshatriya than righteous battle. And when such a battle comes to them of itself like the open gate of heaven, happy are the Kshatriyas then. If thou doest not this battle for the right, then hast thou abandoned thy duty and virtue and thy glory, and sin shall be thy portion." Chapter 2, Shlokas 31 and 2. Happy are the Kshatriyas, Sukhina. Duty and virtue, Swadharmam, and thy glory, Kirtim. He will, by such a refusal, incur disgrace and the reproach of fear and weakness and the loss of his Kshatriya honor. For what is worst grief for a Kshatriya? It is the loss of his honor, his fame, his noble station among the mighty men, the men of courage and power. That to him is much worse than death. 33rd Shloka. Battle, courage, power, rule, the honor of the brave, the heaven of those who fall nobly. This is the warrior's ideal. To lower that ideal, to allow a smirch to fall on that honor, to give the example of a hero among heroes whose action lays itself open to the reproach of cowardice and weakness, and thus to lower the moral standard of mankind, is to be false to himself and to the demand of the world on its leaders and kings. Slain, thou shalt win heaven. Victorious, thou shalt enjoy the earth. Therefore arise, O son of Kunti, resolved upon battle. 2:37. In fact, 34, 36, 37, all that. This heroic appeal may seem to be on a lower level than the stoical spirituality which precedes and the deeper spirituality which follows. For in the next verse, the teacher bids him to make grief and happiness, loss and gain, victory and defeat, equal to his soul, and then turn to the battle, the real teaching of the Gita. To act without passion, to act without desire, the 38th shloka. But Indian ethics has always seen the practical necessity of graded ideals for the developing moral and spiritual life of man. The Kshatriya ideal, the ideal of the four orders, is here placed in its social aspect, not as afterwards in its spiritual meaning. This, says Krishna in effect, is my answer to you. If you insist on joy and sorrow and the result of your actions as your motive of action, I have shown you in what direction the higher knowledge of self and the world points you. I have now shown you in what direction your social duty and the ethical standard of your order point you. Swadharmam api chaveksya. 2:31. Whichever you consider, the result is the same. But if you are not satisfied with your social duty and the virtue of your order, if you think that leads you to sorrow and sin, then I bid you rise to a higher and not sink to a lower ideal. Remember, Arjuna is shrinking here on the battlefield. He is overcome by tamas. This is not rajas, which is governing his nature now. This is an unheroic shrinking from what is his natural duty. And he knows all of this by instruction from his philosophic gurus, who some of them are on the other side of the battlefield, true. And he knows this because he's been trained to look at himself, to govern himself. He knows what is his dharma, and yet he is shrinking. So Krishna says, rise, if you must do something, rise to the higher level. Learn to act from equality. I bid you rise to a higher and not sink to a lower ideal. Put away all egoism from you. Disregard joy and sorrow. Disregard gain and loss and all worldly results. Look only at the cause you must serve and the work that you must achieve by divine command. So thou shalt not incur sin. 2:38. Thus, Arjuna's plea of sorrow, his plea of the recoil from slaughter, his plea of the sense of sin, his plea of the unhappy results of his action, are answered according to the highest knowledge and ethical ideals to which his race and age had attained. It is the creed of the Aryan fighter. Know God, it says, know thyself, help man, protect the right. Do without fear or weakness or faltering thy work of battle in the world. Thou art the eternal and imperishable spirit. Thy soul is here on its upward path to immortality. Life and death are nothing. Sorrow and wounds and suffering are nothing. For these things have to be conquered and overcome. Look not at thy own pleasure and gain and profit, but above and around. Above, at the shining summits to which thou climbest, around, at this world of battle and trial, in which good and evil, progress and retrogression are locked in stern conflict. Remember, he will shortly be asked to realize the summits of his essence, to realize what is akshara, that thing which is imperishable, which is his essential being, and the essence of all things. But also he's challenged to work in the world, to hold it together. There is a cosmic order to be maintained, and the actions of humanity frame the cosmic dispute and possibility. So if he abandons the world, all is lost. The cosmic purpose goes adrift. So, loka sangraha, the holding together of the worlds, is part of his mission. To know himself, to act dispassionately without desire, to do God's work in the world and hold all together in his soul with his arms around protecting. This is a challenge for Arjuna. He's the best man of the age. He has to rise to this. He may only be Arjuna, silver, and not gold. Not the gold of the sun yet, but he can open the doors and climb sunwards. Men call to thee, their strong man, their hero for help. Help then, fight. Destroy when by destruction the world must advance, but hate not that which thou destroyest, neither grieve for all those who perish. Know everywhere the one self, know all to be immortal souls, and the body to be but dust. Do thy work with a calm, strong, and equal spirit, samatha. Fight and fall nobly, or conquer mightily. For this is the work that God and thy nature have given to thee to accomplish. So, appropriate that we read this on the 24th of April. 21st of February, obviously, the mother's birthday. 15th of, obviously, Sri Aurobindo's birthday in August. Siddhi Day, crowning their conjoined efforts, opening the world to perfection with the 24th of April, when she returned to stand next to him again and look out over the Bay of Bengal and realize both together at the same moment that the hour had come to do it, to bring it together, to practice it, to make it real. That means everything. Because wisdom simply held aloft makes no practical difference here. We've had millenniums of sages climbing those ladders of consciousness, reaching sublimity, and yet the world continues unchanged. Prakriti, this world of the triple gunas, can only be changed when we bring sattva up to the level of jyoti, rajas up to the level of tapas, and tamas up to the level of shama, and have those descend here. Light, power, peace, and then in their wake, bliss, ananda. Mahalakshmi, who was invoked today, is the secret heart of all the worship of the Divine Mother. We think of her as only giving blessings, but she withholds her grace as well to the Titans who refuse to regard her more gracious and benevolent aspects, and they do not win. Their darkness loses, and truth does finally emerge victorious. Satyam eva jayate. Sri Aurobindo and Mother, when they rejoined on this date in 1920, opened the realms of possibility. A handful of years later, what, in a sense, culminated all our past evolution occurred when what Sri Aurobindo later called the Overmind descended into the cells of his body and therefore into all the earth substance, no longer simply a sheer pinnacle above, but now intimate, material, something that he held within his own physical being, representing the whole of the cosmos. But steps beyond remained to the gates of the sun, and he advanced with Mother. We've come a very long way, and we are not working in isolation. The 24th is the marriage of wisdom and power. It is the marriage of light to what seems to be darkness. It is light tickling darkness into wakefulness. It is the individual recognizing his place among the many, not by association, but through oneness of being. We have to move from association and mutuality into a deep soul-based harmony. So to work together across the globe is typified in this event, them standing together where they had stood before, years earlier, looking out over that shining sea. They saw the future coming to abide on earth. A beautiful moment captured in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, captured now in Oroville, captured everywhere. There's an open soul who is the center of his own ashram, circle enclosing other circles. Look at you, all of you beautiful souls, all of you part of a single family, all of you here to realize we've all come for the same thing. Shall we not work together? Shall we not do this? Live more from the soul every day and less from the ego, setting away desire, bringing pause to nature instead of stress, pacifying our culture instead of driving it senselessly. No words. Action. Let's do it. Let's fulfill the sadhana each of us is intended to do and link hands invisibly sometimes, lengthily. I see our friends all over the globe conjoin in this one little Zoom space, in this one little room in Pensacola. All of us partners. And I think the potential is immense. We can stand as personal examples and do our best, selflessly, in dedication, offering each moment to her. So I think I've wandered much. There is a section of Savitri that I thought I might read to you. This, you'll think this is ironic. This is in Book 10, the Book of the Double Twilight, in Canto 3, The Debate of Love and Death. And we'll start on page 625. Even wisdom, hewer of the roads of God, is a partner in the deep, disastrous game. Lost is the pilgrim's wallet and the scrip. She fails to read the map and watch the star. A poor, self-righteous virtue is her stock, and reason's pragmatic grope or abstract sight, or the technique of a brief hour's success she teaches, an usher in utility's school. On the ocean surface of vast consciousness, small thoughts and shoals are fished up into a net, but the great truths escape her narrow cast. Guarded from vision by creation's depths, obscure they swim in blind enormous gulfs, safe from the little sounding leads of mind. Ah, safe from the little sounding leads of mind. Too far for the puny diver's shallow plunge. Our mortal vision peers with ignorant eyes. It has no gaze on the deep heart of things. Our knowledge walks leaning on error's staff, a worshipper of false dogmas and false gods, or fanatic of a fierce, intolerant creed, or a seeker doubting every truth he finds, a skeptic facing light with adamant no, or chilling the heart with dry, ironic smile, a cynic stamping out the God in man. A darkness wallows in the paths of time, or lifts its giant head to blot the stars. It makes a cloud of the interpreting mind and intercepts the oracles of the sun. Yet light is there. It stands at nature's doors. It holds a torch to lead the traveler in. It waits to be kindled in our secret cells. It is a star lighting an ignorant sea, a lamp upon our poop, piercing the night. As knowledge grows, light flames up from within. It is a shining warrior in the mind, an eagle of dreams in the divining heart, an armor in the fight, a bow of God. Then larger dawns arrive, and wisdom's pomps cross through the being's dim, half-lighted fields. Philosophy climbs up thought's cloud-bank peaks, and science tears out nature's occult powers, enormous jinns who serve a dwarf's small needs, exposes the sealed minutiae of her art, and conquers her by her own captive force. On heights unreached by mind's most daring soar, upon a dangerous edge of failing time, the soul draws back into its deathless self. Man's knowledge becomes God's supernal ray. There is the mystic realm whence leaps the power whose fire burns in the eyes of seer and sage. A lightning flash of visionary sight, it plays upon an inward verge of mind. Thought silenced gazes into a brilliant void. A voice comes down from mystic unseen peaks. a cry of splendor from a mouth of storm. It is the voice that speaks to nights profound. It is the thunder and the flaming call. Above the plains that climb from nescient earth, a hand is lifted towards the invisible's realm. Beyond the superconscient's blinding line, and plucks away the screens of the unknown, a spirit within looks into the eternal's eyes. It hears the word to which our hearts were deaf. It sees through the blaze in which our thoughts grew blind. It drinks from the naked breasts of glorious truth. It learns the secrets of eternity. Thus, all was plunged into the riddling night. Thus, all is raised to meet a dazzling sun. Yes, it continues. Well, namaste, Jai Ma.